Well, this morning, we're going to discover what Jesus says we should do when corrupt, selfish people get you down. We're going to see what you should do when you're discouraged because it looks like bad people are winning. And we're going to see what Jesus says to do when you feel like you're tempted to compromise your ethics or your integrity because it seems like bad people are getting ahead. Today is a message about trusting God even when it feels like what he's called you to do seems below your potential. It's about when you feel undervalued or underappreciated by the people who are closest to you. Now, let me start off this message by reading from Psalm 37. It's a fascinating praise song, and we don't normally write or sing songs like this. But here's what the psalmist says. Do not fret because of those who are evil or be envious of those who do wrong, which assumes two things, right? This verse assumes that people of faith are likely to become worried, fearful, or upset. Why? Because of evil people who seem very successful. That's the context. The bad guys are getting ahead. And two, there's this observation that just seeing bad people get ahead pulls you into being envious, which means there is this incentive-driven gravitational pull to compromise godly ethics when you just see that people who are doing wrong are rewarded. And you've probably felt this at some level, right? You ever get upset or frustrated because it's always the worst people that get the best platform, right? They get the most money, the most powerful positions and jobs and deals. You ever notice that it seems like the bad people get the most power? It's not fair, right? And it doesn't help anybody. You ever think like this, why am I doing all the hard work of doing things the right way? Why am I putting in the extra time and to have ethics and morals when it really looks like the worst people are getting the most rewards? Okay, I'm seeing some nods. That's encouraging. It's not just me. But if you've ever struggled with the injustice of it all, this is a message that'll help you. But we're going to start off in this psalm, which answers that particular question with two answers. The first answer looks something like this. Do not fret, envy, or compromise. Instead, play the long game. In other words, don't think about next week. Think about decades from now. Think about eternity. Don't fret because those who are evil, verse 2 says, for like the grass, they will soon wither. Like green plants, they will soon die away. In other words, it might not seem fair now, but just wait. Just wait. Grass is seasonal. Life is seasonal. See who seems healthier next year or in the next decade. See where short-term wins and compromises, see how that works out in the future. See how even it affects job or family in a decade. Evil people sacrifice the future for the present. So the first answer the psalm gives is just wait, and even if it's not next year or 10 years from now, think about eternity, because this life is just a drop. That's the first answer the psalmist gives. The second answer the psalmist gives is do not fret because God actually does provide for you. So verse 3, instead, trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and enjoy safe pasture. And the psalmist, I mean, it's a song, right? So you can kind of read the rest of it and it repeats those two answers over and over again, expanding on it. Yep. Things like verse 5, which says, commit your ways to the Lord, trust in him, and he will do this. What will he do? Like, grab onto this promise. God will make your righteous reward, so you do good and you get reward. It will shine like the dawn, your vindication like the noonday sun. In other words, don't be envious of those who are seizing power, doing evil, and doing well. Instead, trust the Lord, and he'll give reward. Verse 7, be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret. Do not fret when people succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. So instead of getting stressed, anxious, instead of clawing for control or manipulating things or escaping because of circumstances you cannot change, instead of freaking out of bad things you can't control, I love verse 5. The psalmist says, commit your ways to the Lord, trust him, he will do this. That's a good word, right? Put that in your car, write it on your calendar. By the way, this is one of the values of gathering and worship. We gather in a revolutionary act of being still when we feel like we should get on a rat race. It's so hard. And sometimes you even sit in a pew like this with complaints. You're on the verge of fear or sneer or tear. You're just waiting for God to act, trusting he's good. And the psalmist says that's what will help you. But the psalm has a chorus. You know what a chorus is in a song? It's a hook. This becomes the title. There's one verse in the psalm that people would have used to refer to this psalm. Nobody went to an Israelite worship service and said, hey, can we turn to number 37? They all said the title, the chorus. You would have thought of the chorus, you would have recognized the words by verse 11, which I'm just going to read, see if it sounds familiar. But, so instead of fearing the evil people, but instead of becoming evil, but the meek will inherit the land, and they will enjoy peace and prosperity. That is the chorus to Psalm 27. That's what it's about. But we're not preaching about Psalms today. We're in a series called Happy and Blessed. We have for weeks been talking about Jesus' incredibly important message that he gives to his followers. It's about life in the kingdom of heaven. And if you follow the story of Matthew, Jesus follows the path of Moses. He wanders around in the wilderness. He experiences temptation. He goes to a mountain and brings down not 10, but 8, and not commandments, but Jesus delivers on the mount a set of 8, what we call beatitudes, a revolutionary way of looking at a world, at the world, in the way of just radically living happy and blessed, waiting for the Lord. And we are on beatitude number 3 today, and sometimes it is overlooked, because instead of Jesus coming down off the mountain and saying something brand new, Jesus quotes something that would have been familiar to everybody, the chorus to Psalm 37. And he says it like this, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. That's basically Psalm 37, verse 11. And I think what Jesus says in the third beatitude is that the Christian life is living out Psalm 37. So your homework is to go home and read Psalm 37, because I'm not going to talk about that today. We're talking about Matthew. So the first question we ask is, what on earth does it mean to be meek? And the first way of understanding meek is understanding everything else that Psalm 37 says. So read all the verses, and you'll find something about doing right, trusting God, not fearing when things seem fearful, not compromising ethics or integrity when it seems like that works better. That's Psalm 37. Instead, you trust God to make things right and avoid the temptation of lashing out or being manipulative or taking things in your own hands. That's Psalm 37. That's what meek means. Now, commentators very quickly point out that Beatitude 3 sounds a lot like Beatitude 1. Beatitude 1 says, blessed are the poor in spirit, which sounds like meek. We took that as being humble and meek before God. Commentators say being meek has less to do with being repentant before God. It has everything to do with how you relate to other people. So less about God, more about people, but they're connected. You find the word meek a bunch of other times. Jesus calls himself meek in Matthew 11, 29. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am, it's the Greek word is paos, which is translated meek. Sometimes you see humble or gentle, but it's the same word translated meek here. NIV says, I am gentle and humble in heart. Again, it's the same Greek word used for meek. And Jesus certainly isn't saying he's insignificant or that people shouldn't notice him or that he's not ever assertive, which tells us that meek means something differently than most of us think of the word. We find again at the triumphal entry in Matthew, tell the daughter of Zion, your king is coming to you. Humble, it's the same word translated meek, and mounted on a donkey. Now, meek, whatever else meek means, it doesn't mean insignificant. He's a king, right? He's a king coming both in power and in meekness. In the Bible, it seems like meek has this idea of someone actually who has a lot of power and authority, but chooses not to use it all the time. It's the idea of being a servant leader instead of an authoritarian. D.A. Carson, you have this in your handout. I think he says basically meekness isn't weakness. It's not being wishy-washy. It's not being indecisive or timid. It's not being unsure or being a pushover. Meek, he says, is not the same as being nice all the time or easygoing. Meekness, he says, is much deeper. And at the core, there is a controlled desire to see the other people around you have their interests advanced maybe more than yourself. It's a word used in this argument with Abraham and Lot. If you remember the story from the Old Testament, there's a debate about who gets basically the best place to live. And Abraham says, you know, I'm going to choose to let you pick. I'll take the second pick. Or in Numbers 12, Moses is said to be the meekest man to ever live. Moses, certainly not weak, certainly not indecisive, but he over and over again refused to revenge himself. He refused to manipulate things when he was getting attacked. He kept going to the Lord. He chose to lead boldly, but lead people that he cared about instead of doing it for himself. Being meek means faithfully and gently trusting the Lord in the same circumstances that you're tempted to use whatever you have to fight or escape in unhealthy ways. When those are the options, it is choosing to wait and believe that God will ultimately make things right instead of manipulating things in ways that make it worse. It's choosing kindness when you think that yelling would get what you want faster. It's so counterintuitive. This absolutely does not make sense because being meek is the opposite of what we see working around us. This is the entire problem of Psalm 37. It certainly does not look like the people who get the power are also humble. If you look around, it looks like corrupt, unethical people get power. But Jesus makes this aggressive promise. Blessed are, of all people, the meek. Why? Because they will inherit the earth. Now, lots of questions to go with this. People ask, is it talking about heaven? It's talking about the new heaven. Is this eternity? And I guess, sure, that's a very easy out, I guess. It's nice to say maybe trusting God now might not get you a lot now, but God rewards you in the future. That certainly may be true, but that's not what this says. It's not what the psalm says. It doesn't say one day in heaven. It says inherit the land, which was certainly something that was available. Let me make another observation. Inherit is weird. Because God is alive, right? It's not like God is going to die and you get it when he's gone. And also, inherit is a different word than owning or having. A little bit of a nuance in Greek, but I would say the headline would be inheritance is stewardship. It's taking care of something because somebody gave it to you. It's like, this is a dumb example. So last Sunday, I went off, I drove to my parents' house to drop off the girls. My mom's here, she brought them back, and they had a great week. But while I was home, and I don't get home that often, my dad gave me an offer. He said, while you're here, I want to give you my most prized possession. He has a beautiful classic drum set, and it sort of looks like what Ringo Starr played. It's beautiful wood, and he's had it since like high school or something, and he's cared for it, and he's consistently upgraded the cymbals, and he's shined the pristine wood and replaced the skins. It is a beautiful drum set, and he doesn't hit it very hard. But he asked me last week, you know, Sam, I'm not going to be here forever, which is weird because he's fine, he's healthy. He said, do you want to take my drum set today while you're here? And I didn't think twice. I said, no, absolutely not. Do you know why I didn't want his drum set? It's a great set. I would love it. I love instruments. I love music. Do you know why I don't want it? Simple reason. He's alive. He's not going anywhere. And inheritance is stewardship. And I know exactly what's going to happen next. I drive it home. I take it out of the car. And right now, I live with my little, hyper, messy, very active kids. And I shouldn't say this, but you should see our couch. We got a couch, and we introduced it to the kids. Kids meet the couch, and just like wilted, it just gave up. Like we can't handle this group of kids right now. I know people who cover furniture with plastic to protect it. Like seriously, we would need plywood and 2x4s. Like this is how it works. We got an active tribe, and they're very active. They're a lot of fun, but the house is not meant for valuable things. And I know exactly what would happen if I took my dad's very nice drum set in about a month. He would ask me, how is a drum set doing? You didn't get dust on it, did you? I've spent 50 years keeping it polished. And I would say, Dad, I got good news and bad news. There's no dust on it. The bad news is one of the kids couldn't find a pool float. And they saw the bass drum, but it's almost dry now, but no dust, so absolutely not. Inheritance is stewardship. One day when the kids are bigger and they move out, and maybe I'll take it home and I'll take good care of it, it'll be great. But for now, I don't want any part of it because inheritance is stewardship. And it's taking care of something because you value the person that gave it to you who's certainly not dead. And God said, let me tell you something about the earth. It's mine and I care about it. And the sorts of people that I will entrust it to, remember, inheritance is stewardship. I am going to give responsibility to my earth to people, and I'm going to pick the meek. The people who say, God is really big, and he loves people, so I'm not going to live for myself, but for the people God has entrusted to me. The meek will inherit the earth. I don't know how this works. But ultimately, humble people are caring people. And that's who God trusts with the big responsibility to take care of the earth. And Psalm 37 makes explicit what Matthew only hints at. Now, you're all asking the same question right now. It's the obvious one. How on earth is God doing this? is this really how the world works? God seriously somehow blesses humble, gentle people with more influence, and they have more stewardship. Is that really what's happening in the headlines right now? You're going to ask me that, and I'm going to say, it's a good question. How is God doing this is a question. It may be what you're asking, but it's a question that God seems very uninterested in asking here. There's a bigger question God is asking. It's not what God's doing, it's what you're doing. The question is, how are you doing this? How do you act gently and meekly like Jesus? How do all of us become the sort of man and woman that God gives more earthly influence to? And the first answer is not what you'd expect. And it's the obvious one. You might expect that God gives you influence the exact same way that you see everybody else getting influence. The way that compromising, prideful, arrogant people get power. In fact, when you see bad people getting ahead, the Psalm says, one, don't worry, it's temporary, focus on what's given you, which is really hard, right? We see how misbehavior is rewarded, and we get upset with the injustice of it all. That's true, But we also think that's how it works. We think that if you want power, if you want to get ahead, you have to act like that. It happens in schools and communities, in line at Dunkin' Donuts, in traffic, right? We all do this. We see the worst people get ahead, and we think, well, I should start driving like that too. I'd get there faster. So the first answer is not like that. Don't replicate how evil people get ahead. God cares about it. This is one of the most consistent themes in the Bible. The second answer is how Christians steward influence, and it is not the ways you would expect. It doesn't look like that. So last week, I gave 6 messages at Ocean Grove, and I recycled some of the messages I gave you from Ephesians, and that was fun. Next week, I'm actually away. I'm speaking at a Lake Chapel next week, and I'm happy to tell you guys that Pastor Dave Lyman is coming back. You're in for a treat. But last week, I just talked about Ephesians all week, and I was struck. Like, when you do it fast, you get struck by the big picture of it. And I was struck by the progression of Ephesians 5 before 4. And the progression looks like this. You discover how big God is. Ephesians 4, Jesus has all the authority in heaven and on earth now and forever. He's won victory. And then Ephesians 4 talks about what Jesus does with all of his power. And it's weird. Because instead of Jesus keeping it, he gives it away. He gives to his people gifts, the earth now an inheritance to rule on his behalf, which is a weird pivot. Jesus wins, and you are his body. Massive theme. And then after that, like, chapter 5 comes after chapter 4. And if you read chapter 5 after 1, 2, 3, and 4, I'm expecting, it's a question, how is Jesus going to rule the world using us? What does inheritance look like? And if I were writing the Bible, I'd be talking about big, impactful, front-facing actions. If it were up to me, because I've seen how power works, I would talk about government and culture. My chapter 4 or 5 of Ephesians would look like, you know, we got to go to Rome and get a Christian emperor, or at least a governor somewhere. I'd write about how we need to get more Christians in Hollywood and get more movies out there. Or wouldn't it be great if, I don't know, Taylor Swift would promote Jesus to millions of people? That's where my head would go. Let's get the big, powerful, influential people that everybody's looking to influence. And when you read Ephesians, that is exactly not what it does. Paul talks about not the powerful, but the meek. After talking about how Christians have all the authority in the world on behalf of Christ, Paul goes really small. You read Ephesians 5, it talks about personal sexuality, like the most unseen parts of our thoughts and actions. How even the parts that people don't see should reflect God and his holiness. And then he talks about, like, he doesn't go to the emperor, he goes to kids' church. If you read Ephesians 5, he goes talk to the most small, meek category of people. Then he talks to parents, and he basically says, dads, no one else sees if you yell at your kids in the privacy of your home, but your kids see it, and God is watching. Don't exasperate your kids. So small, but so impactful. And then he talks to employees, like the bottom of the chain, and says, you know, no one else is watching, but God is. And he talks to bosses and says, look, you have power over the waiter who's serving you. God cares how you treat people. And you read Ephesians 5, and you would be underwhelmed by the tiny influence that all of God's power displays. Because when you read it, it looks like character and integrity when no one is watching. And the problem with doing things when no one sees is that no one sees. And that is not the normal model of success. Normally, I mean, you know what success looks like. It looks like things that everybody sees. It looks like influence before people. And we all make this assumption that God works the way that the world works, because we see all the stuff up front, power grabbing, manipulation, and we both feel it and we think that that is how God's power ought to look. But Jesus says something. This is hard. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. That God actually gives stewardship, influence, power to the meek. That what God sees when no one else sees, those little things actually matter. And of course, you could only be meek, you could only be unafraid while you're trusting in and waiting for God. It is only when the finished work of Christ is your foundation that you can walk and wait and walk through frustration and injustice and despair. It is only when your vision of God is how big he is and how long-lasting it is that you can wait and trust him and not be afraid. And again, there's some mystery to this. I can't explain how this works. I live in a tension of Psalm 37, where it sure looks like the most powerful people in the world are the worst people in the world. I can't say this, though. Here's what I have seen. I've seen it work the other direction. I've seen how proud, corrupt people, even Christians, are unhappy and unblessed. I've seen people crash and burn and lose influence fast when they fail in the small things. You can tell a lot of stories, right? I'm convinced that the biggest damage to the influence of the Church of Christ isn't our inability to get people in government or pass laws or make movies. This is obvious. The biggest loss of Christian influence comes from the lack of character when no one is watching. I mean, think about all the commands that Ephesians gives in Ephesians 5. Think about how damaging a failure to obey those commands has been. I mean, think about, you could just take one of those commands. Think about how sexual scandal has damaged the voice of the Christian church. Think about how not listening to authority or being lazy or taking shortcuts. Think about how many bad parents have messed up so many kids. The little things actually make the longest, biggest impact in both directions. The biggest, the showy things may have less of an impact than you think they do. Jesus says he changes the world through the meek, humble, kind, consistent actions that changes the world even if we can't see it happen. And I think that is exactly what Jesus calls each of us to. When he comes off the mount and says, "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth." So Father in heaven, I pray that you would give us eyes to see what we can only imagine, that yours is the power and the glory both now and forever. And Father, as you rule the world through us, may we be the humble, meek, obedient, trusting, hopeful people of integrity that you entrust your world to. May you see our faithfulness in the little things and the big things. And can you reward us with the sort of impact that changes the world to look more like your holiness and righteousness? I ask all this in your name and in confidence that you are always with us, you're always faithful, you always love us. I ask this in the name of Jesus. Amen.